Storm damage? Call Lakeside Roofing. We've got you covered. Beware of fly-by-night storm chasers. Lakeside Roofing is family-owned and operated, serving Greater St. Louis for more than 40 years. We are committed to customer service, quality products, and outstanding workmanship, with a solid reputation of reliability and competitive prices for both residential and commercial roof systems. For a free estimate, call Lakeside Roofing at 618-344-2800 or 314-241-5253 or lakesideroofing.com. Choose experience. Choose Lakeside.
Now, back to Jay and Joe on CBS Sports, 105.7 HD2 FM, 920 AM, and InsideSTL.com.
Second hour of the afternoon drive, CBS Sports 105.7 HD2 FM, 920 AM, InsideSTL.com. If you are just getting off of work right now, just tuning in for the first time, big news today, Colton Wong has been optioned down to AAA Memphis. He will be, making his way. I guess they're playing the Iowa Cubs. You think when the Redbirds and the Iowa Cubs get together, you can throw the record books out?
Sure,
you think
those two,
you think they just teach them at a young age, like, you must hate this other team? Sure, you might be used as trade chips for the big league club, but while you're here, while you're a Redbird and they're a Cub,
you hate them. You hate all things Iowa and in Chicago and wherever else their minor league affiliates are.
Uh-huh. I think, what do they have, Boise? I think the Cubs are in Boise, Iowa, and I believe they are now the Kane County Cougars.
I used to go to Kane County Cougar games way back in the day.
That's a long drive from Marquette.
No, that's when we used to live in Lake Zurich, Illinois. Oh, okay. We used to go to Kane County Cougar contests.
Never been to it. Never went. All my years living on the South Side, never went to a Kane County Cougars game.
I think at the time, they were a Marlins affiliate, and I had a glove signed by a bunch of them, and I recently found it like a year or two ago, and I tried to see if there's no one famous.
Oh, not like Benito Santiago?
I was really hoping, like, how cool would it be if, like, Josh Beckett is signed on this, or Dontrell Willis, but no.
Dontrell, I would have thought more like a Benito Santiago, maybe on, like, a rehab assignment.
That would have been cool as
Jeff
well.
Jeff Conine.
No one I recognized.
You're going Josh Beckett. That's 12 years ago.
Kane County Cougars, by the way, now the Class A affiliate of the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Really?
Yes. Iowa Cubs, Tennessee, Myrtle Beach, South Bend, and Eugene. Per Baseball Reference,
so
they
no
don't
Boise,
have
huh?
a rookie or a foreign rookie club. That's weird.
Hmm. Well, anyway, those two teams playing tonight.
They used to be in Boise. They left after 2014 in Eugene, Oregon.
No, really, nothing on tonight. Is there a hockey game on tonight?
There is. Rumor has it there's a hockey game on. I'm told there's one on Saturday. I'm also told the Sharks won that game. So evidently now it's 2-1. I
might fall into an update on Twitter.
Yeah, same here.
That's really, I might accidentally see a result, see a final score on Twitter outside of that.
Maybe there's a foreign hockey call of the game that makes Deadspin. I'm like, oh, that guy scored.
Yes.
That's neat.
And we play that and we don't even care to ask.
Nope.
What the, we don't even care to ask. What the result was. Mm-hmm. Giamatti asking if I've had my 50,000 tweet yet.
Oh, that's the big update, Joe. Have you had 50,000
Giamatti,
tweets?
I was three away from it on like Thursday or Friday.
So you're like, you're at 52,000 now.
Gee, I almost went over it. No, I'm at 50,027.
What was your 50,000th tweet?
This is my 50,000th tweet.
Oh, you would do that. How meta of you. God.
I almost sent one out, and then I went over and I scrolled over to look at what it was, and I was like, oh, crap, I'm at 49,999. I was like, I can't send this tweet out, so I had to cut it.
Wait, hold on. So you had another thought. You had a hot take stealing about something.
No. I believe, and I got to go through and look at how the timeline ended up for this, because I believe I don't know what it was. I can't remember what it was. I think I was going to retweet something, and I went through, and I tweeted out what the show was.
Mr. Hopfinger had a hot
49,999
tweet.
Are you looking at all the replies to it?
I am looking at the replies to it.
Yeah. Nope, that was rude. That was rude. He's lucky he didn't get muted for that. Didn't just throw the old mute there on it.
So what's your next Twitter milestone? Is it 100,000, or do you, like, manufacture one in between, like 75,000?
You know what happens And this is seriously what happens is Jay will point out a number that I'm at, and then I realize.
Okay.
Like, Jay's the one that actually keeps count on that. Jay's obsessed with me. He goes out there, and he'll log on to my account. He'll look at what I'm tweeting, and then I'll get, like, texts about it from him. I'll get messages from him about things that I tweet or that I'm over-tweeting or what number I'm at. And then he'll make a big deal out of it. So I don't pay attention to this. It's Jay that pays attention to it. And that's what kind of brought to my attention that I was close to 50,000 the other day.
All right, let's see.
It was all Jay.
So you're a little over 50,000. Your Twitter account says that you joined in April 2009. So I'll give you the benefit
of the
doubt.
Which that can't be true.
I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, and I'll say it was April 1st. We'll give you the maximum amount of time imaginable. To today, which is June 6th, 2016. You've been on Twitter now for 2,623 days. So if I just say you had 50,000 tweets, that means on average,
okay,
you have tweeted 19 times a day.
That's not true.
That is so on average, you have had 19 individual thoughts that you thought everyone else needs to see this.
I've retweeted a few. See, that doesn't count retweets. So you see, retweets and replies. It's retweets and replies that add up. That somebody's going to say something to me, I'm going to reply to them. Like, we found this picture today. Imig found this picture today. It was posted in the Players Tribune. It has in the picture Tiger Woods, Wayne Gretzky, Monica Seles, Carl Lewis, Joe Montana, Jack Nicklaus, Michael Jordan, Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Pele, John Elway, Chrissy Everett, Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Evander Holyfield, Billie Jean King, Pete Sampras, Jackie Joyner-Kersee, and some guy.
It is quite possibly the greatest collection of athletes ever in one photo.
And some guy who you, me, Emig, we had no clue who this guy was. And he's kind of off to the side, too. We're like on one end of it, Wayne Gretzky is touching Carl Lewis.
Yeah.
Has his hand on his arm. We're like, look, I'm in this picture where this other guy is a good step and a half away from Jackie Joyner-Kersee, where he might have just jumped in the picture at the last moment. It's like when you do, you know how you do the end of the year, like how in high school, you'd have everybody from this class all get together in the bleachers and they'd all take that picture. And we always did it outside. And we had one guy that thought he'd be clever because it was kind of a panoramic picture. He started on one end, on the end that the picture started on. And he ran behind the bleachers to get on the other side. So he's actually in the picture twice because of the way it scanned the panorama. Kind of neat, but, you know, he wanted to be in the picture twice. That's what he did. So I tweeted out. I wanted to know who it was. Wanted to know who the guy was that was standing next to Jackie Joyner-Kersee. Of course, the first person to reply said Billie Jean King.
That's mean. No, that was mean. That's an accomplished tennis player.
I wrote, who was the gentleman next to JJK? I knew that answer was going to come, but it was mean. It ends up, it was Olympian Bob Beamon.
That is a name I haven't heard in a long time. I believe, does he still hold the long jump Olympic record?
So.
He did for a time. I think he set it. God, was it?
I think he broke it. It was broken like 91, I thought, is what
Look
I saw
that.
On Wikipedia.
It was broken by Mike Pyle in 91.
Yeah.
Look at
but
you.
Again, the collection of talent that was there is pretty amazing. And yes, Bob Beamon held a world record. It just doesn't seem like with all that talent there, all the collection of people that was there, that it seemed like he stuck out a bit. I wanted to know who that was. And thankfully, people on social media were able to help me out with that. But I tweeted that picture out. You can go find it on there. It's from the Players Tribune where that picture was. Hey, joining us now to continue our discussion here this afternoon on the great Muhammad Ali is a man who covered him for many, many, many years from Sports Illustrated. That is Gary Smith. Gary, good afternoon.
Hello. How's it going?
We are doing well. Would you, for our listeners, take us back to the first time that you met Muhammad Ali and just that first time covering the champ?
Yes. I was a 25-year-old cub reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News, and they sent me up to Deer Lake. Ali's preparing to fight Larry Holmes well deep into his career, and he's on the real downside at this point. But so I go up there thinking I'm going to be up there, and there's going to be a flotilla of big-time reporters up there, and I'm going to just skulk in the back of the pack and get my quotes and notes and get out of there. But I arrive there, and he's just finished his workout. It's been a long workout. He's exhausted. He's laying on the massage table, and the old Cuban masseuse, Luis Sarias, you know, just working him over, and his eyes are closed, and I'm the only reporter there, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is not what I pictured that was going to be like at all. And then one eye opens a crack. He sees this nobody kid there, and he says, what do you need? And so I tell him, and he opens his other eye and gives me 2.5 hours, just me, nobody else there. And so that really told me a lot about who he is, and you know, this is a different kind of cat here.
The relationship from there just was, so after that, how did the relationship grow from there?
You know, I never would call it a relationship. Ali was a magnificent in the moment, a man of great immediacy, but not the kind of guy that I found was going to, like, you know, pick you up and call you, pick up the phone and call you. And so I won't go anywhere near as far as call it a relationship, but I just had the good fortune of, you know, 6 or 7 times after that of being, you know, able to sit down with him and spend time, you know, in a mansion he lived in L.A. when he was in that phase of his life with married to Veronica Porsche, you know, in his Michigan farmhouse in a much quieter situation when he ended up with the wife that he ended up with for the latter part of his life, Lonnie, just a girl from around the corner in his neighborhood in Louisville where he grew up. But he was always, first of all, he was funny. He had a twinkle in his eye, and he, you know, was to play practical jokes. So there would be, you know, just say when riding with him in the Santa Monica Freeway, even with the Parkinson's, his eyes would start to close, you know, or at least that day is what happened. His eyes started closing, and I'm in the, you know, passenger seat trying to figure out whether I should, what to do here, because the wheels are clacking over the lane markers. We're drifting from lane to lane. Cars are honking at us, and I'm really getting very nervous and trying to decide what to do, not wanting to reach over and, you know, kind of grab the steering wheel out of the hands of Muhammad Ali. But his eyes at this point are, like, closed. And so this goes on for several minutes, and I'm really tense at this point. As much as the writer in me would kind of like to see what happens if there's an accident, it might be helpful for the story. I'm really getting very, very anxious. So at that point, all of a sudden I see little spindly arms come from the back seat. His 12-year-old son had been quietly sitting back there, reached over his shoulders and took the wheel and driving us from the back seat at, you know, 60 miles an hour down the Santa Monica Freeway. So, you know, it just leaves you kind of bewildered. Is this something that there's two of them, you know, a trick he's played on a number of people, or what really was happening that day? I'm still really a little unsure, but that's the kind of guy he was.
Gary, I'm sure Ali's reputation preceded him before you went to speak with him. I guess, what were your expectations as to how it would be to deal with Ali, and then did it differ greatly from what you experienced?
Well, I guess I just was seeing him so many times growing up on TV, on screens with, you know, Howard Cosell, or with mobs of media and big press conference situations, that I just figured that he'd be kind of numb to all that by that point, that there wouldn't be that kind of, you know, the personality, the humanity, and the connection you'd feel with him. I didn't think I thought he'd, you know, guys that are in that position, they usually get a little dulled to that whole thing, and they go through the motions more, but it never felt like he was going through the motions with him, no matter where we ended up. I mean, when I went and found him in 1988, you know, this 7 years after he's retired, he's well into the Parkinson's at that point. And, you know, I show up there, and this farmhouse he's living up in Michigan, and he says, "Hops, let's get in the car." And he takes me to some little abandoned gym and hands me a stopwatch and starts, you know, shadow boxing with the heavy bag and having me call out the time, the end of each round. And, you know, and he it's almost like he's creating scenes for your story for you, and he's taking care of you somehow. That he would feel that would always be there, that immediacy with him. It was never just felt like going through the motions, and then inviting you back to eat at his house, and then I went to the bathroom, and I try to get out, I'll leave the bathroom, and I can't open the door, and thinking, what is going on? Have I locked myself into Ali's bathroom? How have I done this? So for, like, you know, 5 minutes, I'm pulling on the door, trying to get out, and finally I hear this little titter, and he's there, and he's, like, holding the door, holding, you know, keeping his legs hold up in his bathroom. But just that kind of stuff, just, you know, just that, there's just a real human quality to it, and it was just always fun being around him.
When, what was the first time that you could really start to see the Parkinson's kind of taking over?
It was, you know, I think it was when I was working on that. First of all, I worked on a story about Angelo Dundee, his trainer. And it was in that story that I started to realize that, boy, there'd be a really great story about this whole entourage, what happened to them, you know, when that Ali comet stopped. And so I just met him at that point in a coffee shop in Chicago, and he gave me all I needed about Dundee. It was great, but I was starting to see he was really slow, and it was really slowing him down. The words were coming slower. And then within that year, I met him up at Michigan Farmhouse, and then you could really see it. I mean, it was pretty amazing once he took me to that abandoned gym and how quick he was moving for that first round. By the third round, he was dead on his feet. And then the amazing thing about him was, like, when he took me to the car afterwards to drive back from that, just how accepting he was of this condition. Here's this guy that was so lightning and so fast with words, and just lit every screen up he ever came near. It was so difficult to watch him try to get even his key into the car to open the door, but there was just not even a glimmer of complaint, of awkwardness, of, you know, of self-consciousness about it, like him feeling like he's putting me out, or embarrassment that he's having to be in this condition. He would just, like, keep plugging away. He'd just keep kind of stabbing it at the key, at the lock, and just keep doing it until he got it in. And then, you know, we just kind of driving back to his place, and then he decides to show me the barn where he's got all the pictures of his glory days. And we go in there, and there's all the pictures. There's some birds that gotten into the barn, and pigeons, and all these pictures of all these glorious moments. You know, he's surrounded by kings and presidents and celebrities, and there are all these, like, bird crap over all of them. And, but again, without any complaint, any irritation, the pigeons up in the rafters, he just walks around and turns all the pictures. There are 30 of them, easy, and just turns them all to the wall, one by one. They're all, you know, bird crap over all of it. And it was just so symbolic of what was happening to him. But the way his response was what was remarkable. It was just no disgust, no irritation, no embarrassment. Just quietly turned them all over. It was almost like he was taking a lesson, absorbing the lesson of life, of impermanence. And just taking it and processing it, and just turned them all over once, and turned out the lights in the barn, and let me out the door. No comment at all on it. But again, no embarrassment or anything.
The legendary sports writer, award-winning sports writer, Gary Smith, joining us here on the Afternoon Drive, CBS Sports 105.7, HD2 FM, 920 AM, and inside STL.com. Gary, I'm only 31 years old. Brian is a few years younger than me, so we don't have the memories of getting to see Ali fight like a lot of people do. But I would say my first memory of Ali, at least the, you know, knowing how great he was, probably came back in 1996 when he lit the torch in Atlanta for the Olympics. That was a huge moment. I remember watching it on TV. But as a person who covered a lot of Ali, many, many years, decades of Ali's career and life, what was, or how big of a moment was that?
Well, I was at, you know, at that opening ceremony of those 96 Olympics, and, you know, having seen him from the beginning, having been in closed circuit theaters watching like the Ali Frazier fight, just all the drama, just how magical those nights were. And then, you know, having experienced him, you know, in more private moments, like I've mentioned to you here, but then suddenly, and not to know that kept a secret who was going to light the cauldron. That's always kind of a big deal to open these games up. And all of a sudden to see the spotlight swing up to that lip of the stadium, see him up there standing with that thing, and now he's got to light it. It's like everyone, the whole world, you could feel, was holding their breath because that thing is just shaking in his hand, and he's got a light, that torch he's holding, light the big cauldron, and the thing is just trembling. And it was an incredible moment. I mean, some people, you know, I spoke to Carl Mildenberger, who was one of Ali's opponents, and he was like, oh, why did they put Ali in that spot? They ruined it. That was terrible. It was, it was to see a man like him, a champion in that condition. For me, I thought it was great. To me, he said, you know, Carl felt it destroyed the picture of Ali. To me, it completed the picture. And the fact that Ali allowed the world to see, you know, that kind of downward decline that we all face, different forms, that he allowed us to see that and be part of that. It completed the picture like a Greek tragedy. You know, we see the rise of someone, and then we see the whole ride. And that, to me, that's the humanity of it. It's really cathartic and good for all of us to see it and share it and process it.
Gary, you covered hundreds of figures, both of large scale and even of more localized scale in your fantastic writing career of Sports Illustrated. Where does Muhammad Ali rank for you personally?
Definitely probably the most intriguing character. Again, I have to repeat, I still say, if you go back and look at the clips of him in his prime and those early years of his career, I still don't think anyone, you know, even bringing celebrities like Elvis Presley, even if people like that may come close, but to light up a screen, I don't think anyone did the way he did when he was all on at his first third of his career, first half maybe even. But the other thing that's kind of special about him, I think, is that most of the athletes, virtually all the athletes we see, they're on their own personal crusade to prove something, to make more money. But he figured out that if you plugged into something larger, you could carry it somewhere way further. I mean, when he was in his dire moments of challenge, athletic challenge against Frazier, against Foreman, by that point he had figured something out, that he was, in a way, doing it for this, for the world. This was a worldwide mission, and something much bigger was at stake. And so he could use that energy. He was using energy, plugging into a much bigger generator, a power, you know, source than most athletes are. Most athletes, it's their individual thing, and that's great to a degree, and they can ride that energy a long way. But Ali had this bigger power source that he could plug into, and that's why he was able to go even longer way. I mean, Frazier took him, as he said, to the doorstep of death, and he was still able to somehow, you know, prevail. I mean, Foreman, to take the punishment he took from Foreman in order to pull off that incredible strategy in that the fight in Zaire. I mean, again, he had to be plugged into something larger just because he had to survive incredible just a beating and the endurance of doing that round after round. So he plugged into something larger, and not too many athletes even since have that understood that. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do to figure that out and be able to use it, but he did, and that's why he went to places that athletes haven't gone within their sport and even beyond it.
If Muhammad Ali was in his prime in 2016, how do you think he'd be viewed, and do you think he still would have been a boxer? Do you think he would have been an elite athlete in some other sport?
If his background was what it was, he'd be a boxer because it's hard to project somebody if they're at any the personal circumstances have been different. But if his personal circumstances were what they were, boxing is not the sport it was. At that time, it was held such a huge piece of the public's imagination in a way that it doesn't now, that it's really hard to say if that's where he would have gone. Incredible athletes. You got to believe he would have done something, on a large scale, because just to see a man that big who could move that quick, he was going to be something athletic. The question is, would he have had the social impact he did? And I got to believe he would have. I think there was something in that man that had to raise the stakes beyond merely, again, my crusade to prove to people how good I am and how much money I can make. He needed large stakes, world-sized stakes, and he would have found them, and they would have dragged him inevitably into social causes and even political ones at times. So I got to believe somebody with that outsized of an energy, spirit, instincts. I mean, he was excessive. There's no doubt about it. He believed that he lived in excess. He didn't worry about consequences. He made choices that would have consequences. It would scare most people to death. But he would just not sit and play that game of figuring out where is this all going to lead. He would just do it. He lived by instinct.
Gary, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this afternoon and share those wonderful stories about the Muhammad Ali that you knew back during your time of covering him.
My pleasure, guys.
That is Gary Smith. He was with Sports Illustrated 83 to 2013. And I got to say, too, when we talked about having Gary Smith on here at the station, the writer's block is the three guys that write for the Post-Dispatch, and all three of them. I mean, you could tell what kind of influence that Gary Smith has on writers, because Ben and Derek, all three of them had kind of heard that and were like, oh, God, he's great.
It would make sense that he would appear on a show of such journalistic integrity
right.
as just the Afternoon Drive.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yes.
They could have had him. They could have, Gardner could have sent that text out. He could have had him. We could have taken Jackie Joyner Kersee as well, and I know she had some great stories. A lot of great stories have been told about Muhammad Ali here on this station throughout the day today. I got to tell you, Gardner last night was texting the number that he had for Jackie Joyner Kersee, and he was he was afraid that it wasn't really her. Because he just got back he sent out this big long text, getting her to join the show, and he got back sure, can I call in? And Gardner's I don't know if this is really her. Did you Google the number? Did you see what comes up there? He's yeah, just his cell phone. Okay. And so I texted somebody to see if maybe they had her number to confirm, and they didn't have a number on her. And so I'm go for it. I'm sure it'd be fine. Would have really, really liked it.
In the moment of confession, he had asked me for a number. When I heard of Ali's death, I had a few people on my mind who wanted the book for both this show and for Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought about JJK. There are a few other ones who I tried who got shut down for reasons of scheduling conflicts, mm-hmm. Roy Firestone and such. I never thought of JJK just because I wasn't thinking about 90s athletes when mm-hmm. Ali passed away. So I said, all right, She's in my phone as JJK. I have no idea if it's her. I have no idea if it's real, because it could very well just be a manager of hers. And
right.
I just labeled it that way for to call it. But go ahead, give it a shot. So that's probably why he was thinking that it may not be her.
We do have plans of being joined throughout the week, especially once Jay joins us for the first time this week on Wednesday. As you can imagine, Jay has his connections with that. And I mean, it was just last month that Jay and I interviewed the woman that was running the Muhammad Ali Museum down in Louisville,
Kentucky. Yes.
So, you know, it was just a month ago that we were talking about him and the impact that he had and what he meant to the Louisville area. And knowing now that he had passed away, I do regret not driving around his old neighborhood down there and doing that. You know, it's a regret that I have not doing that. But could you imagine Muhammad Ali first won the heavyweight title back in 1963. He was born, when was he born? 42. So that would have made him 21 years old when he won the title. Imagine 21 years old, what we know of Muhammad Ali here in today. If he was 21 in 2016, just imagine what he would have been like and how he would have been received, knowing everything or seeing everything that we see every day, and whether it be politics or just the world that it is.
I mean, we're at a time, and I didn't think of this when you posed this in the 3 o'clock hour. I thought of this since then. Think of all the god-awful, unnecessary, bad hot takes that spewed from the mouths of hot take artists when Jose Bautista flipped his bet.
Right.
I mean, people got up in arms over that. Imagine what would happen today with Ali and his opinions and actions, and not even what he did in the mid to late 60s when he refused to report to Vietnam. Just like I was watching this morning, I put together a little compilation for Frank of just Ali smack-talking to his opponents. Like they were talking about Sonny Liston, and he just says, he's too ugly. You don't want an ugly guy being the world champ. You mm-hmm. want a pretty guy like me. Can you imagine if someone said that today? Like, oh, that's not being a good sport. And we get upset when Cam Newton does the Superman thing.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, people would be entertaining. There'd be a lot of ugly hot takes.
Yeah, there would be. Oh, my gosh. There would be so much. Oh, the fact that he had religious stances and wow. Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's something to think about as we go on here. That's I like that. I saw somebody tweet this out too over the weekend, was don't look at how all the politicians that you're seeing that are tweeting out things about Muhammad Ali now. Think of how they would have treated a 21-year-old Muhammad Ali today.
Some aren't treating him well now, yeah. There's one who deleted a tweet about him being a draft dodger. It's just,
really? Who was that?
I saw Deadspin. It was a Tennessee Republican.
Really?
Not a well-known political figure. I need to try to get his name real quick.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, you look that up. I'll tell folks about Mike's Automotive. Had to. I told you. Remember the terrible day I had last week? Failed the emissions test, but had to go take it up to Mike's Automotive. They fixed it all. Passed today. I passed my emissions today. My car is okay to drive on the road in the state of Illinois. Now I just have to go give them more money to make sure I get a nice little sticker on the back of my car that says I'm okay to drive it. There you go, Rauner. Have fun with that. Hate that state. But anyway, Mike's Automotive has two locations in that state, Collinsville, Millsdale, and one in this state of Missouri. That is on Ivory Avenue in South City. They also have location in Collinsville and in Millsdale. Find them online, mikesautomotive.net.
It was Representative Martin Daniel who tweeted this out on June 4th. Cassius Clay is a skilled great boxer, but failure to enlist in the U.S. military when the call was made is a black cloud on his character.
Mm. All right.
That's a hot take.
That's a bad take. I just started following an account. I believe it's Freezing Cold Takes.
Yes, I have followed that too. That is an outstanding account to follow.
It's okay.
My goal is to get you on that. I want to get you on that account, Joe. I want them to retweet something you said.
But then it's not a freezing cold take when you say something and then 4 years later you were wrong on it. Okay, that's not a freezing cold take.
Some of them are.
That's taking a stance on something.
No, some of them are.
Freezing cold take is going, man, I could really see the Cavaliers winning this series, but the Warriors have a really good team too. Like that's a bad take.
Freezing cold takes being dead wrong.
That's a bad take when you just kind of hum and haw and you go, hey, you know what? Hey, the Cardinals, they could make the playoffs this year, but watch out for those Cubs. They're gonna have a good team too. No, take a stand one way or the other. That's a cold take. Okay, have your hot takes. I have no problem with that.
Hot take.
There you go.
Son of Giamatti. Bless it.
No, cold take is when you're dead wrong. That's what it is. That's what a cold... No, when someone says, my favorite...
Like, this part, they're pulling something up from 2003.
Joel, hot takes do not have an expiration
NBA
date.
In 2003.
There is no expiration date on hot takes.
13 years later.
They're like honey. They're like cockroaches and Twinkies.
This
hot takes will survive a nuclear winter.
This take is getting ready to go to high school. That's how old it is. It's fine to be wrong on a take 13 years later.
No, it's not. Wrong is wrong. Doesn't matter how long ago it was. A bad opinion is a bad opinion, no matter how long
ago
you expressed
it. But it wasn't bad 13 years ago. It could have been good.
What'd they say?
It was about Dwayne Wade not being good enough to be the number five pick in the draft.
Well, that's a bad hot take, because what's he done since then? He's won, what, 3 NBA titles?
Okay, Shaq helped him win one. LeBron won him, helped him win two.
Wade won the MVP on one of those, didn't he? You want to throw 6, right?
Buck from the County, that should be the name of the show, Joe Rod's Frozen Takes. Shut up, Buck. Take a break. Back with On This Day. It's Afternoon Drive, CBS Sports 105.7 HD2 FM, 920 AM, InsideSTL.com.